Before we begin, if you want to join our growing group of supporters and give $5, $10 or $20 a month to help make the show even better, you can sign up to the Harder Reports Patreon right now and get exclusive access to full, unedited interviews with guests. That's the Harder Reports Patreon at patreon.com/theHarderReport. And now, today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Harder Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by David Walsh, the chief sports writer for the Sunday Times, three-time UK Sports Writer of the Year, the key journalist who uncovered the Lance Armstrong doping scandal, and the author of the new book, The Russian Affair, the true story of the couple who uncovered the greatest sporting scandal. David Walsh, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
For those who haven't had a chance to pick up a copy yet, could you tell us a bit about your book, The Russian Affair, and the actions of Russia in the sporting world here that led to this?
It's the story of Vitaly and Yulia Stepanov. They're a husband and wife team who basically provided the initial evidence that precipitated the investigations that led to Russia being banned from international sport for 4 years. He, Vitaly, was was an employee of the Russian anti-doping agency. He believed in clean competition. He believed that doping was wrong, and he was incorruptible. She was an elite 800 meter runner, part of the doping system. You know, on their very first date, she told him the truth about her doping, and in a way, it was an incredibly unlikely romance. But they got married 2 months later. And this would be a real problem through the early years of their marriage, where she was doping and he was fighting doping. And through kind of force of circumstances, they ended up on the same side. In other words, she converted to anti-doping. And it was through their efforts and Yulia Stepanova's efforts in particular, because she was the one who really went and got the evidence that the Russian kind of state-supported system of doping was brought down. And for me, it's what was interesting about the story was that you had this incredibly difficult marriage, you know, or what you might call a very turbulent love story set against the backdrop of a doping conspiracy, that the two people involved in the relationship that wasn't so smooth we're trying to expose. And the kind of, you know, the conflict between trying to kind of keep their own marriage going while trying to expose a massive conspiracy to cheat is, for me, what makes the book kind of different to other books. These, Yulia and Vitaly, are not any, you wouldn't call them any old whistleblowers. You know, they're a very particular couple, fascinating to me. And I must say, I enjoyed, you know, getting to know them and then helping them to tell their story.
Do you think that from your experience, Russia is an outlier here in its actions? Or do you think it's the case that we're just not aware of other countries that engage in similar activities to what Russia have been found to be doing? Because obviously there's been concerns about doping in various sports from various nations.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word outlier. I think Russia, though, is unique because it was so state-supported. I mean, the people in power in Russia saw doping as giving them a competitive advantage. In other words, if we do doping better than every other country, that will give our athletes a better chance of winning the biggest races. If they win the biggest races, it's going to reflect well on Mother Russia. And that's really what we're interested in here, to make our own population feel good about themselves. In other words, they watch the Olympic Games and they see the Russian flag, you know, going right to the top of that flagpole and the Russian anthem playing with some Russian athlete having a gold medal around their neck. That's good for the morale of your own citizens, and it kind of, you know, kind of helps the notion that Russia is a very powerful and successful country. So the state had a big interest in Russian success. You know, in other countries, doping is more capitalist. It's more down to individuals doing their own thing. Of course, it happens. But one of the reasons, say, that Yulia Stepanova realized that not everybody was doping like the Russians were, she would look at the Diamond League series of athletics meetings that go on during the summer. And she would look at all the people competing there. And she would say to herself, the reason we don't go there as Russian athletes is we don't want to subject ourselves to testing at this time, because we're building ourselves up for the Olympic Games that maybe come at the end of that Diamond League series of meetings or in the middle of it. But she looked and she sees other athletes from other countries turning up every other week for a Diamond League meeting and being tested. And she comes to the conclusion that they're not doing it like we're doing it. If they were, they couldn't do this. And people might find the story about sports and doping a bit dispiriting, because they'll say, well, look, aren't they all cheating? Well, actually, they're not. And cheating is quite difficult, because there is a World Anti-Doping Agency, and there is plenty of testing. In other words, take yourself to the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014. Russia's created this incredible infrastructure. $50 billion, apparently, were spent on creating the Winter Olympics of 2014 in Sochi. President Putin absolutely wanted Russia to be the leading country in those games. But how did they get past the doping controls? Because their athletes were, many of the ones who would win gold medals were doping. So what Russia did was, Russia basically created an alternative lab alongside the official lab, and they were able to steal the samples overnight, get them out through a mouse hole, open the bottles, drain the urine that had doping products in them, replace it with clean urine that had been taken from those athletes months before, and in that way defraud dope control. Now, if the tests were ineffective, Russia wouldn't have had to go to such lengths to cheat. But they did go to those lengths, and even still, they got caught. So it isn't actually as easy to cheat as people may think. And there are always honest people around. And if there is a moral in the Russian affair, or a message that people should take away, is that how come that Vitaly Stepanov, a relatively lowly employee of the Russian Anti-Doping Agency, should decide that he wasn't going to accept all the corruption? Why is it that he would put his job at risk, which he did, to expose the cheating? He got sacked because they knew they couldn't trust him to keep their secrets. He then went further and encouraged his wife to collect the evidence, putting both their lives at risk. So why would they do that? They would do that because they're basically good people who didn't like cheating. So I've spent a lot of my life writing about doping. And the Lance Armstrong story was quite depressing in terms of how many people conspired with Armstrong to conceal the truth from the public. I found this story in many ways more uplifting, because here you have two Russians challenging the system in Russia and then exposing it. So it was a kind of a pleasure for me to be involved with him. And then, you know, the bit that makes the book different in my eyes, and the bit that if people buy this book, they will be, I think, confounded by what they read. Because Vitaly and Yulia haven't just blown the whistle on Russia's state cheating. They have talked with incredible honesty about how dysfunctional their marriage was when he was the anti-doping zealot and she was the committed doper. I mean, they really shouldn't. They should never have got married. But heterosexual attraction, any kind of sexual attraction, you know, is a strange thing. And people become attracted to each other, and they kind of ignore things that really shouldn't be ignored. Well, if you're going to dope and I'm anti-doping, we're going to have problems in our marriage. That was obvious. They did have problems, huge problems. And it's remarkable that in their telling of the story, they have been as brutally honest about their own relationship as they have about Russia's system of corruption.
Given how corrupt the Russian system that these two individuals shone a light on is, do you think it's possible for Russia, now it's been banned for its actions, to really clean itself up and become honest and play fair? Or do you think because this corruption was at this point so ingrained in Russia's sporting system, as you mentioned, it was state-sponsored, that it's just something that will always be at least in the back of their mind and their activities?
Yeah, I do actually, Edward, I do. Because one of the difficulties is when you use powerful doping products and you create an infrastructure that enables that doping. See, Russia, they weren't stupid in this. The only part that got them was the athlete biological passport. They didn't understand how that worked. That's the only reason they got caught. They didn't understand that all these values, normal values, could be used against an athlete when they produced abnormal values. And the abnormal values wouldn't have led to a positive test, but they weren't explainable relative to all the profile had been built up. This is who you are in terms of your blood values. And suddenly, everything is out of sync. You've got far more red cells now than you had 6 months ago. That's not normal. 2-year ban. And Russia didn't understand how that worked, and it got them caught out. But in other respects, for years, they got away with it because they did a huge amount of testing. I mean, I'm a journalist, sports writer with the Sunday Times. I'm interested in this stuff. So there's a service there that tells me last week there was 4 people banned in Russia. 6 weeks ago, there was 2 people banned in Russia. And I'm reading the results from around the world. And Russia has more positives than anybody else. So I'm thinking that proves that Russia's got a great system. What I didn't realize was Russia was catching its second and third tier athletes, the ones who weren't going to be part of the team. But because they were catching them, they were giving people around the world the impression that they had a legitimate anti-doping system going. So you people would say, oh, I don't believe in Russia. And a guy like me would have said to them, well, last week there was 4 Russians tested positive. I mean, there haven't been 4 people in the UK test positive for the last 12 months. So what's going on here? Is it because, you know, they've got a better system of catching them than we have? And so they got away with it. But one of the difficulties of having this really powerful state-supported doping program is you stop doing other things. Because the drugs work so well, there's no need to focus so much on nutrition. There's no need to focus so much on kind of science. There's no need to focus so much of your time on what constitutes proper rest. So Russia then falls way behind in terms of all the advances that other countries are making. So when they stop doping, they're going to drop off, you know, the face of the earth in terms of being competitive. And that's going to take time for them to start doing all the things they would need to do to make them competitive that don't involve cheating. It's like cheating was the crutch that enabled the Russian system to work. And when you take away the crutches, you realize then that the patient isn't ready to walk without crutches. And that's going to be the problem. And that's going to be the bit that would make Russian athletes think, you know, we've just got to go back to doping because there's no other way to be competitive.
Systematic doping saw Russian athletes be stripped of more medals than any other country. And in 2019, the World Doping Agency banned Russia from all major sporting events for 4 years. Do you think that ban is severe enough? Do you think the punishment fits the crime here?
If they made it 8 years, I wouldn't complain. But I do think that when you ban a country, you ban a lot of innocent athletes. There will be athletes in Russia who have never doped, young, somebody who was 15 when this started, who's now 19 years of age and is ready to compete at the highest level. And they maybe are looking at another 4 years of a ban. Well, does that person deserve to be excluded from international competition? No, that athlete does not deserve to be excluded. They're paying for the sins of their predecessors, the sins of their political bosses, the sins of their sporting bosses. So I suppose the compromise would be that because there's a lot of what we might call civilian casualties in this ban, we'll make it so that it's not lifetime. They won't lose their entire career. They will only lose half their career, because that's what it will mean. I mean, the average athletic career is going to be about 8 years. And somebody is banned for 4 years, well, they lose half their career. So I think it's about right now. This ban is being appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And the Court of Arbitration for Sport will be very mindful of the fact that innocent people are going to be caught up in this ban. And who knows how they will react. I think Russia's obviously got it's a very difficult appeal for Russia, because they were involved in systemic state-supported doping. And there has to be some penalty for that. So it'll be a surprise if they succeed in their appeal. But to answer your question, I think 4 years is probably about right.
While Russia can't compete as a nation, Russian athletes have been given the opportunity to compete under a neutral flag if they can prove that they have not engaged in doping, they're clean. Do you think that we'll see many athletes doing that in competitions like the Tokyo Olympics? And if so, do you think that should be allowed? I know you mentioned about innocent athletes being caught up there. Do you think there's a potential for this to be exploited as a loophole, not just by those innocent athletes who then get to compete, but athletes that would try and work a way around the system?
Well, it's quite difficult because we know the system of doping in Russia. Those athletes who were involved in that system can't really hide it. Some international federations at the moment, for example, the World Athletics, formerly the IAAF, they're not prepared to allow neutral Russian athletes into their competitions. Other sports may well do that, and some, I mean, for example, if you were a Russian shooter, you know, or fencer, it could be that you're involved in a sport where the likelihood of doping, you know, where there's no value to be gained from doping. Well, do you exclude those people who when your starting point is, we know they didn't dope, we know that people in their sports don't dope, but we're still not having them at the Olympic Games. Well, that's tough. And I do understand that there is an absolute need to ban Russia. And if they compete as neutral athletes, I think it's quite difficult for Russia to have neutral athletes there, because people are reminded every time they see them. You see that guy in the grey and white top competing in such and such a final. He's a Russian. And then the next logical question is, well, why isn't he running in his Russian team vest? Because he's not allowed to wear the Russian colours. He's just won the gold medal, but the Russian flag isn't being raised. The Russian anthem isn't being played. So for me, it's almost like if I was a Russian high-ranking politician, I'm not sure I would even want neutral athletes going there, reminding the world of why Russia isn't allowed to be represented as a country at the Olympic Games. I mean, that's a big thing for geographically the biggest country in the world, not allowed to go to an Olympic Games as a country. But I understand also why people would say there should be no Russians there. I can understand both points of view. I would tend to say, look, let's judge every neutral athlete application for inclusion on its merits. And if we're utterly convinced this person had nothing to do with doping, and the International Federation is allowed to leave, is prepared to have them in Tokyo, I wouldn't be raising too many objections.
You've written this book, The Russian Affair, about doping by Russia. You've previously wrote two books about your investigation into Lance Armstrong, LA Confidential and Seven Deadly Sins, My Pursuit of Lance Armstrong. Given that sports is a very closed industry, with many individuals concerned about saying or writing the wrong thing for fear of irritating influential figures, were you concerned about that when you went after these individuals, when you reported on these stories?
No, not really. Your assumption is right. You know, you go after those stories and people have reservations about you. They think, oh, what are you looking for now? You know, I better be careful if I speak to you because you're a guy who'll print everything. There's an element of that for sure. But at some point in my journalistic life, I kind of thought, I don't want to be part of deceiving the public. And if I'm at a sports event and I feel this isn't right, there's something wrong here, well then I've got to be true to how, you know, because in sport now, I don't know if you watch football, say, you watch Premier League football and it's on TV and you're sitting in your living room and you're on your own. And you don't think the game is very good. You don't think it's a very high standard game. But the commentator and the co-commentator and the pundits are kind of giving you the impression it's a better game than it is. They're hyping it up. The one thing that you have as a fan is the right to your own emotional, intellectual reaction to that game. You know what? I didn't think it was very good. And I'm not going with the view that this was great. And I would say to all fans of all sports, that's what you've got. Don't be persuaded by what they're telling you, because the TV company may have a vested interest in hyping it up. The sponsors definitely have a vested interest in hyping it up. And the TV channels, of course, you know, they have that vested interest. So my feeling when I looked at Lance Armstrong was, this isn't believable. Now, I've got to absolutely back that up with some evidence and start digging and see what I come up with. And that then gives you a sense of doing a job that's worthwhile. You know, you're not going with the flow. You're not kind of basically accepting the bullshit. And with Vitaly and Yulia, it was a different starting point, really. It was, these two people are genuinely heroic. And if I can help them, you know, financially by because they needed money as well, because they had nothing when they fled Russia. If they can make a little bit of money doing a book, that would be worthwhile. But the greater purpose really was to let the world know what a fantastic job these two people have done. And to say to people, you know what, you might think that Russia is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. We read all the time about the assassinations and people being killed in suspicious circumstances. And in this case, you know, two former bosses of the Russian anti-doping agency died in suspicious circumstances in early 2016, within 11 days of each other. The guy who's currently the head of the Russian anti-doping agency, put out a statement 2 weeks ago, Yuri Ganis, where he said, I do not intend to commit suicide. I am very happy with life. If you read that I commit suicide, it will be a lie. So he feels his life is in danger because he's taken an almost hardline view in Russia, saying, we were wrong. We deserve to be punished. We should not be appealing this. We should be accepting our punishment. That view hasn't gone down well in high places. And he's had the courage to come out and kind of, you know, take that position, but with the caveat that he doesn't intend to commit suicide because he believes that he may be assassinated. So when you think of Vitaly Stepanov, this doping control officer with RUSADA, taking on the system. I mean, if you couldn't be inspired by that, I mean, why is it If I ask you, why is it that one of the greatest whistleblowers sport has ever seen was a Russian guy? Why is that? Well, my argument would be, I know it's, you will say it's a little bit of a simplistic one, or you might think it's simplistic, but the conclusion has to be that there are good people everywhere. And some of them actually have the courage to do the right thing in the most difficult and challenging circumstances. And that's what Vitaly did. And then he convinces his wife to join him in this pursuit. And it's like she used to say to him, like, what makes you think that you, this lowly guy in the Russian anti-doping agency, this tiny cog in a whole string of interlocking wheels, can have any impact? You know, this is the Russian state you're talking about. Who are you? And there's a line in the book that says, you know, if you think you're too small to have an impact, just consider the mosquito. You know, that little insect buzzing over your head at 4 o'clock in the morning with the power to completely disrupt your night's sleep. And Vitaly and Yulia were two little mosquitoes that caused untold difficulty for the Russian state.
Obviously, these individuals in Russia have faced severe pushback for coming out and telling the truth. The two central figures of your book now live in the United States because they can't stay in Russia. Do you think that individuals in your industry also face pushback for trying to tell these stories? I mean, have you ever faced pushback for trying to tell these stories and uncover what's going on within sports? And if so, who holds the power here? Do you think it's journalists that are investigating the truth and these whistleblowers, or do you think it's these key influential figures behind sports that sort of control access?
Yeah, well, there's no question the key influential people you speak about, they've got more power. But journalists don't have no power. We have some power. We can have some influence. But it depends on the lengths we're prepared to go and the persistence we've got before we can discover, you know, what we can do with our power. So I don't consider that journalists have no power, but that when you come up against very powerful individuals, you've got to be pretty resourceful and thick-skinned. One of the first stories I investigated when I was a much younger journalist was the head of the Olympic Council of Ireland was a man called Pat Hickey, who subsequently went on to become a member of the International Olympic Committee. And I wrote about what was relatively low-key, kind of corrupt behaviour in Ireland. And I got 26 legal writs from Pat Hickey. And it was quite, you know, I mean, upsetting for my wife, certainly, because this president of the Olympic Council of Ireland would send his legal henchman to my home with a legal writ. And when a lawyer turns up in your doorstep and you're not there and your wife is there and she's maybe pregnant and she's getting a legal writ from a guy telling her that her husband is in big trouble and that she has to accept this writ, which she didn't have to. I'm the only person who must accept it. And that is quite difficult. Of course, the case never goes to court because the Olympic Council of Ireland president doesn't want to go to court. And if you remember Rio Olympics 2016, the Brazilian police put out a video of arresting IOC member from Ireland, Mr. Pat Hickey, for the sale of tickets, because scalping tickets in Brazil is a criminal offence. And Pat Hickey was accused of that and arrested for that. And he obviously had to resign as Olympic Council of Ireland president and resign his position from the IOC. And but the pushback comes, and that's when you really have to say we're achieving something. There was an old man, an older man, he's no longer with us now, who used to I used to work with him in the Sunday Press in Dublin. And when the legal writs came, and I used to get really concerned about him. He used to say, David, they're the Oscars of our profession, those legal writs. They are as close as you come to an Oscar. And I go along with that. When you get legal writs from people, and I obviously was sued by Armstrong, went on for 2 years, he won, he was cheating, and our libel laws in the UK backed him. When it was perfectly obvious to anybody who gave the subject 10 minutes consideration, you could see he was a lying cheat. But our laws protected him. And eventually the truth would come out, but it would take another 6 years. And the Sunday Times, you know, basically lost £1 million. Which 7 years later they got back. But that's what it cost them. But when you get that pushback from powerful people, I mean, I don't know any journalist who gives up at that point. That just hardens you. That just makes you think, if ever we doubted we were on the right track, now we know we are on the right track, because these powerful people are going to such lengths to shut you up.
You talked about the legal warnings you received and also the impact that those libel laws had when you were investigating the Lance Armstrong case. And at the time, with that one, the Sunday Times took out that ad in the Chicago Tribune where they talked about Britain's draconian libel laws and how they've been used against the paper. Do you think that the system that exists and the legal options available to these individuals at the moment under the current laws pose a threat to journalists and journalism that's trying to seek to uncover the truth?
Yeah, I do. I think our libel laws in Britain are ridiculous. I mean, just consider this. At the time I was investigating Lance Armstrong, I got three people with direct evidence of his doping. One person who worked in the team for 5 years, who basically had collected drugs for Armstrong in Spain and brought it back to France. Another guy who'd been in the same team as Lance before Lance got cancer, and they had discussions about doping, and Lance was the strongest advocate of doping in the team. And this guy was party to some of those conversations. I had a woman who basically was in a hospital room when Lance told his doctor, she heard him tell his doctor that he had used performance-enhancing drugs during his career as a cyclist. All of those three people were prepared to sign sworn affidavits saying, this is what I heard, this is what I saw. And that wasn't good enough. You know, it's like, we couldn't write that without being sued. And Lance sued us. If we'd written that in France, absolutely no problem. If we'd written that in the US, no problem. But in Britain, all Lance needed to say is, well, I've got five people that say those three people are liars. And we couldn't report it. So we did report it, we got sued, and we have to issue basically what was a grovelling apology to Armstrong and pay £300,000 towards his legal costs. And he was able to tell other journalists that, you know, that I had got sacked for printing lies about him. Now, I'd never got sacked. There was never any suggestion from the Sunday Times I would be sacked. In fact, the messages I was always getting back from the Sunday Times is, you're doing a good job, keep going. But once Armstrong sued us, our hands were tied, and it would take another 4 years before we could start, you know, re-looking at the case, because new evidence came out, you know, very strong evidence from Lance's former teammate, Floyd Landis. And that really gave us a path back into the story, and we were able to write again. But it's nice, actually, with Vitaly and Yulia, in that we don't have any of that legal issues, because they're the whistleblowers. They got the evidence. And if there was one thing that I take away from the Russian affair and what Vitaly and Yulia did, was maybe because they were Russian and they fully understand how people lie, they realised that without incontrovertible evidence, the story was going to go nowhere. And that's why they taped and videoed people, and plenty of them. I mean, I don't know exactly how many people Yulia taped. I would think about 14, 15 people. Many of them got, some of them got life bans, other got 8-year bans, 4-year bans, you know. But that amount of evidence couldn't be contradicted and wasn't.
David Walsh, thank you for joining me.
You're very welcome, Edward. Thank you for having me.
That was David Walsh, the author of the new book, The Russian Affair, the true story of the couple who uncovered the greatest sporting scandal, which is available to purchase now. You can find out more about him and his work on Twitter at DavidWalshST. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about the interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe. Or recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family.
Thank you to this month's supporters on Patreon: Carolyn, Colin, Ibalashnikov, Janet, Jesse, Merrily, and Nikki, who helped make this show even better.
Until next time, goodbye.